Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting, who examines the flaws and vulnerabilities found in electronic voting systems being used across the U.S. William Greider, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the grassroots movement gathering to challenge conservative Democrat U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. And Ardith Platte, a Dominican nun and peace activist recently released from federal prison for anti-war civil disobedience, who talks about the conditions for women she encountered in jail. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For 26 years, the U.S. Senate has refused to ratify the Global Bill of Rights for Women, officially called the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. The treaty has been approved by 170 nations, and the U.S. is the only industrialized nation to oppose it. Women's rights advocates see a great deal of hypocrisy in the American position. As Ruth Sharma of the Women's Edge Coalition told the website OneWorld.net, the U.S. wants to protect women's rights across the world, including the Middle East. But that rings a little hollow if it does not sign the Women's Rights Treaty. However, U.S. opposition to the Women's Bill of Rights is not unique. Washington is hostile to a growing number of international conventions on weapons, global warming, and the rights of children. The Bush administration is opposed to a long list of UN conventions, such as the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty on Nuclear Weapons, the Anti-Landmine Treaty, a new compliance agreement for the Biological Weapons Treaty, and the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, held up the adoption of the two-year UN operating budget, insisting the UN make management and administrative changes. 20 years ago, people power in the Philippines drove brutal dictator Ferdinand Marcos out of power. In 2001, tens of thousands of Filipinos returned to the streets and pushed President Joseph Estrada out of office for accepting millions of pesos from illegal gambling activity. Yet the streets of Manila were relatively calm in 2005 when Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo was charged with manipulating the May 2004 election. She later apologized for a lapse in judgment and successfully stopped efforts to impeach her. According to The Nation magazine, anti-Arroyo activists could only mobilize 40,000 people in mass protests, far fewer than the hundreds of thousands that jammed Manila streets to oppose Marcos in 1986 and Estrada in 2001. Observers blame apathy in the belief that the entire political system is corrupt. Increasingly, people are leaving the Philippines for better opportunities in Europe, the United States, and the Middle East. It is estimated that 30% of Filipino household income comes from 8 million citizens working overseas. There is also growing frustration with a stagnant economy that is guided by Washington-backed neoliberal policies. The Philippines' once powerful non-governmental organizations and human rights groups lost their voice when many protest leaders joined the government bureaucracy. But a new generation of activists emerged in the Arroyo crisis, calling for participatory democracy and a new transitional government. The people of rural Alston in northeast England face a pressing local crisis, shrinking population. The town currently has 2,000 residents, just 10% of its former size. To combat the flight of its residents into bigger urban areas, the town has created its own matchmaking agency, recruiting people to move in looking for mates. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, countries across Europe and Japan have seen fertility rates fall below the recognized replacement rate of 2.1 children per couple. The population has fallen in 7 of the 25 European Union countries. Still, with rising migration into big cities like London, the overall European population is expected to rise to 470 million people by 2025. It is then expected to decline by 50 million people. Increasingly, birth rates are also falling in the developing world, some dramatically. According to United Nations data, 20 developing nations have birth rates of 2 children per couple. While population stabilization seems to be occurring, activist groups like Greenpeace and Oxfam have dropped the issue from their agenda in favor of campaigns focusing on global warming and fair trade. A quiet debate is now going on about the environmental benefits of decreasing population versus fears that fewer people contributing to the workforce, tax base, and social programs could make current societal structures unsustainable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Federal and state programs initiated after the disputed 2000 presidential election to repair the nation's flawed voting equipment resulted in cities and counties across the nation purchasing several different types of electronic voting machines. However, investigations by citizen groups have revealed serious problems with some of these machines. One of the major manufacturers of electronic ballot machines, the Ohio-based Diebold Election Systems Company, has been the target of recent investigations into their voting system security. Soon after a December test in which a Finnish computer security specialist demonstrated that vote totals on Diebold machines could be altered without detection, Volusia and Leon counties in Florida have dropped their use of Diebold equipment. Upon hearing about the Florida tests, California's Secretary of State Bruce McPherson announced that his office is putting the certification of Diebold voting devices on hold indefinitely, while it awaits further testing to validate the system's security. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting, who examines the serious flaws found in Diebold's machines and the very real possibility that thousands of communities around the U.S. may not have certified voting machines in place for this November's midterm congressional election.
California has decided not only to hold off on certifying the Diebold machines, but in a really elegant move, they are sending the machines back to the federal testing labs, saying we want certain things examined. And what's so interesting is the things they asked to be examined are two specific programs that the testing labs now claim they never saw or never looked at. But these two programs we now know are in the machines. They are a violation of FEC standards. In other words, they're illegal programs. And the Secretary of State of California said to the testing labs, here are these two programs. I would like you to give me a formal report on what they are. And I think that sets up quite a trap for both Diebold and the federal testing labs. Pennsylvania has now decertified some of the Diebold machines. North Carolina, Diebold has had to pull out of because they've passed some very restrictive laws. Volusia County, our favorite, has also now dumped the Diebold machines and may actually sue the state of Florida for authorizing those machines in the first place. St. Louis County, Missouri, has dumped the Diebold machines. And what we're doing now at Black Box Voting is to do one more step of testing. This time we need to find an election supervisor somewhere in the country who can let us confirm that this illegal program is in their touch screens. We've been able to confirm it in the optical scans. We've seen it in a touch screen system. We know it's there, but we need to formally confirm it on the record with our public experts. And I think that, if and when we get that, will be the final death blow for those Diebold touchscreens.
But I take it from your research and statements I've heard you make before that eliminating Diebold machines, or if a state puts in place a paper trail that is now actually the law in many states around the country, that in and of itself does not solve the problem.
Correct. You know, you have to fight it battle by battle. But the other biggest voting machine company is one called Election Systems and Software, ES&S. I just got an email this morning from a scientist that is working with another group besides blackboxvoting.org, and he has found the illegal programs in the ES&S machines, at least in the old ones. So I think what's going to happen as we start to finally pry the lid off of Pandora's box is we're going to find that most of the major manufacturers have been using illegal code. And then we've got a tough decision because we've got an election coming up. If we have no voting machines that are actually legally certified, then what do we do? And I don't really have an answer for that, and I'm sorry that I don't, but you know, it's not the citizens' fault that we ended up with this boondoggle in the first place.
So you're looking ahead to the November 2006 congressional election, very important congressional election, where actually a lot's at stake.
Right.
And you got two problems, I guess. Number one is there's a lack of confidence generally among a certain important segment of the population that really doesn't trust the electoral system. And then, of course, if problems, the Diebold machines and ES&S machines come to the surface in a bigger way in the intervening months now in the November elections, you got more of a credibility problem. And then you're saying if they can't be certified, there's no machines to have elections on.
Right. It really is a problem. And let's look at something even more fundamental. I mean, it was a little bit hasty and wrong-headed to run off and say we're going to make ourselves dependent on voting machines in the first place. Look at what happened in Louisiana. New Orleans had to cancel elections. Now, here are some people who really wanted to vote because they had some issues they want to deal with. They had to cancel the elections because the machines were flooded. You know, I'm sorry, but we still have copy shops. We can still make ballots. There's still pencils that you can get. And it's very strange to me that we have decided that we can't possibly run an election simply by filling out paper ballots and counting them. I know that it's complicated, but I think we've really opened a problem up here by making ourselves completely dependent on these machines because all kinds of things, you know, what the least of which is we shouldn't trust them because the machines are not secure. Now, we always hear, oh, you know, Canada does paper ballots, but that's different because they only put one or two races on the ballot. We love to load our ballots up with all kinds of things, and that changes the equation. But there is a township in New Hampshire that has 3,500 voters, so that's larger than the largest precinct. They have up to 30 questions on the ballot, and they hand count, and they have their election results in by election night, often ahead of the voting machines. I think what we need to do is start seeking out the expertise of these places and find out how they have it organized and how they do it. You know, go and look at a role model who actually gets how to do it using the same kinds of challenges we have elsewhere, and so that we can get a backup plan in place.
That was Bev Harris, founder of the group Black Box Voting and author of the book Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Visit her group's website at www.blackboxvoting.org. Just after delivering his State of the Union address in January 2005, President Bush embraced and kissed the cheek of U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. The conservative Democrat, who was presidential candidate Al Gore's running mate in the 2000 election, has infuriated many in his party over the last few years by supporting Mr. Bush on several key issues. Progressive Democrats in Connecticut and around the nation were angered by Lieberman's kind words for President Bush's proposal to partially privatize Social Security, which ultimately failed. Lieberman's steadfast and vocal support for the president's war in Iraq has also created animosity toward the three-term senator, who supported several of Mr. Bush's controversial cabinet appointments. Over the past year, a grassroots movement of angry Democrats has begun to search for a candidate to challenge Mr. Lieberman when he runs for re-election in November 2006. Former Senator and Connecticut Governor Lowell Weicker has expressed interest in the plan. Lieberman ousted Weicker from his Senate seat in 1988. The well-organized liberal group MoveOn.org has also stated its interest in raising money for a Lieberman challenge. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with William Greider, the Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent, who explains why he believes an effective campaign against Lieberman could have national repercussions in reinvigorating the Democratic Party.
Well, he's described in the big media typically as a centrist, and I suppose you can say almost everybody is at some point in their lives. Right now, I think he's center right. He's very close to the Democratic Leadership Council. He's very close to business interests, and not just Connecticut business interests, although they're important to him. And he is very, I think, very much in line with the Republican neocons on the war. The war is galvanizing people's feelings about Joe Lieberman, surely more than on any of those other subjects. But there's been a lot of resentment out there for quite a while among people who think of themselves as rank-and-file loyal Democrats, liberal in their persuasion on most issues, worried about things that in his youth Lieberman himself was associated with. as you know, MoveOn.org, which has a pretty substantial base in Connecticut, was saying if the voters in Connecticut who are part of our network of activist voters decide to do this and they really have a plausible candidate and go forward, we'll support them, we'll help them. And that's a pretty serious thing now in politics, because Move On can raise a lot of money. And I think what's interesting and potentially important about this is that what the Democratic Party has been missing for some years, I mean several decades really, is the ability of the grassroots to get back on its feet and say, we're going to start holding people accountable for wavering on principles, basically turning their backs on the loyal constituencies in favor of seeking that magic middle. If voters in Connecticut do that and have some real impact, that could be the start of something big.
There's a lot of frustration among many progressive Democrats of the weak, kneed, kind of spineless positions the Democratic Party in general has taken during the last 5 years of this Bush administration. So you're thinking that any kind of profound and, as you say, successful opposition to Joe Lieberman could sober up a lot of wavering Democrats.
I actually wrote this in the book I wrote now nearly 15 years ago, Who Will Tell the People, where I was describing the decay of the both political parties. But Republicans understand this a lot better than present-day Democrats, that part of the whole representative system we call democracy is based on the idea that citizens at large, constituents, voters, will now and then hold their incumbents accountable when those incumbents essentially break their trust with their base of that they're supposedly representing. I have watched the Congress now in Washington for longer than I wish to say, but decades. And what I have observed is that nothing gets the attention of incumbent politicians in this town quicker, more powerfully than seeing some of their colleagues taken down by an issue and by constituents who felt ignored and who indeed were ignored. And that was a principal element in how the right wing built its ascendancy within the Republican Party and ultimately how it changed the Republican Party. So I'm suggesting to people who are frustrated and angry, if you are not willing to do this, to assert accountability as citizens, you will continue to be ignored. And that's a logic every politician, I don't care left, right, center, understands.
Let me ask you a quick last question, if I could, William Grider, and that is on Lowell Weicker. Although, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, we don't know if he's going to run against Joe Lieberman this November. What kind of candidate do you think he would make, a former maverick, quote-unquote, Republican senator who challenged Richard Nixon during the Watergate era and an independent governor of Connecticut? Do you think he could successfully challenge Joe Lieberman?
My sense of Lowell Weicker is that he is distinctively himself, and that's a big asset. And he's never been, from the 1970 on, anybody's boy, right? I mean, he just isn't. Which I admire, and he's also, I think, in terms of issues, he's a Republican and not hostile to business. I think of him in the lineage of Rockefeller Republicans, which is a type nearly extinguished, as you know, in the Republican Party. And he's still there, being himself and in a very provocative, independent way. I'm told by people who live there that he's got a tremendous respect good feeling from among Connecticut voters. So my guess is what they say is correct, which is that he would give Lieberman a very serious run. The only downside I see in that, and this I hear from Democrats, is that you could wind up in a weird situation where Republicans, conservatives, right-wingers cross over and vote for Lieberman, and you end up splitting the vote two or three ways so that Lieberman comes through, basically, because the opposition to him is now splintered. But, you know, that doesn't bother me either. There are a bunch of people across the country talking about doing challenge races within the Democratic Party. I can't tell you how many of them are really serious or can really find a plausible candidate that might take a real bite out of the incumbent. But my view is, at this point, I'm for long shots and I'm for good bets. I'm for whatever stimulates people to get out of their chairs and become active and take their convictions seriously. It really comes down to that. If you want your convictions to prevail, you've got to do more than simply yell at the TV set every night. And I see that happening, so I'm feeling hopeful.
That was William Greider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his piece about Senator Lieberman titled The Rise of the Rebels in the December 24th edition of The Nation, or visit the magazine's website at www.thenation.com. Sister Ardith Platte is one of three Dominican sisters who took part in a plowshares action in October 2002 in Greeley, Colorado. The nuns entered a Minuteman missile site, hammered on the silo, and made the sign of the cross on it with their own blood. In April 2003, they were found guilty of interference, injury, or obstruction of national defense materials and degradation of government property. Platte, who was 70 years old and a peace activist for many decades, received the longest sentence, 41 months. She was released on December 22, 2005, but still faces 3 years of probation and must pay restitution for damage at the missile silo. Platte and her co-defendants say they are unwilling to pay the government restitution because some of the funds would be dedicated to war. The nun served part of her sentence in Danbury Federal Prison in Connecticut, and shortly after her release spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about conditions for women she encountered in prison and how women there forged a community among themselves.
I always feel that we are the ones that care about each other. And so, of course, I love people with whom I'm living and walking and working. I listened to so many stories, shed many tears, rejoiced in celebrations with people. I mean, we are for each other, all that we have. You know, we're under the domination of a hierarchy of people, and we're always under their monitoring. So all of the work is done by prisoners. All the food is prepared, all of the electrical, plumbing, ground care, all of the federal housing of the staff people, all of the construction needs, all of the lawn care, that's taken care of by the prisoners. There usually is one supervisor for each of those areas. We do all of the cleaning within the building. I happen to be privileged, I feel, to do chapel as a chapel clerk. That gave me the responsibility to serve all of the different faiths and practices and rituals in the prison of all the people. I also had an opportunity to worship with people in different faiths and to learn about their beliefs. It was just a great privilege for me. I felt honored to, you know, to learn more about Muslims and Buddhists and Native American spirituality, Jewish, Jehovah's Witness, Wiccan, all the different faith traditions. So to me, that gave me an opportunity, too, to listen to people's stories, especially when they lost their parents or when their grandmothers died or when someone was sick in the family. You know, I feel that the greatest service that is rendered is through the spiritual needs. And there, again, a lot of that depends in different prisons upon chaplains. But I just felt honored to work for the chaplains in the Danbury prison.
There have been exposés lately of the terrible medical care that prisoners receive. I know you yourself had a serious medical problem while you were in Danbury that was not treated properly.
The medical treatment is not sufficient. I don't think anyone given a sentence of any number of years was given a life sentence in the sense that they are designated to die within a prison. And in fact, the budgets that are cut first again are those that would be beneficial for prisoners. While I was at Danbury Federal Prison, in just the one unit that I was in, I know of four people who died. I also know of persons who committed suicide on the compound of Danbury. I can't imagine what families suffer when they send their daughters to prison in self-surrender or in designated sentences, and then they never come out alive. I think that would be one of the greatest sufferings, because even when they come in ill, they deserve treatment. Now, many of the women who come in have, for example, lupus or sickle cell anemia, or have been injured, yes, by drug abuse. But aren't we responsible then for trying to treat the drug addiction and to heal the person so that they will be good citizens within the community once they are released? I feel also that those that have committed suicide within the prison system, that prison is responsible for the people there. They're under their guard, their vigilance on an ongoing basis. And if they're that desperate that they commit suicide, it seems to me there should have been enough vigilance to care for them that would never happen. Because there are persons who need deep psychological treatment. There are many persons who have health needs. That seems urgent. The educational needs are urgent. The skill building needs are urgent. I would think that if we really cared about what we are paying for in prisons today, that we would be doing much more in a positive way so that when women go back to their families, that they can live well within the community and help their families within the community. Recidivism is very expensive, and the prisons are extremely expensive. So in order, again, to eliminate a prison industrial complex as it exists today would be one of my motivations, and I will speak about it as I return out into the community and address issues.
That was Dominican Sister Ardeth Plate. Contact Sister Plate's peace community, Jonah House, by calling area code 410-233-6238 or visit their website at www.jonahhouse.org. For more information on the Plowshares disarmament actions, visit www.plowsharesactions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.